Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Illinois was number 5 in the nation last year for its home foreclosure activity. While the nation's foreclosure rate went down about 3% last year, Illinois' rate went up 33%. That's according to the Chicago Tribune. The Chicago area appears to be ground zero for home foreclosures in the state. Meanwhile, there are some efforts to control the foreclosure rate, and we'll be talking about them with our guests today. Jeff Smith is the executive director of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also a University of Illinois alumnus. Jeff Smith, welcome to Focus. And the Reverend Eugene Barnes is executive director of the Metanoia Centers in Champaign, a faith-based group that's been working with homeowners facing foreclosure. Reverend Barnes, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Jim. Glad to be here.
And we'll be welcoming you to the conversation as well. You can join us on the air with your questions and your comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And your questions are welcome on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. I just said that the foreclosure problem in Illinois was at its worst in Chicago, and I was wondering, I don't know which you would want to chime in here. Is that true in all respects? Is there are certainly a lot of people in the Chicago area, and therefore a lot of foreclosures. Is, say, the per household or per capita foreclosure rate higher in the Chicago area than it is downstate?
I think in Chicago, you see obviously there's a high concentration of the state's households and houses are in the Chicago region. And I think if you look at Cook County in particular, where Chicago is located, you see not just a high concentration of households and mortgage lending activity, but you also see the highest concentration of foreclosure activity as well. And within the city of Chicago and within parts of Cook County, you also see some of the longest term and highest concentrations of foreclosure activity in certain neighborhoods.
Well, Reverend Barnes, you were also telling me that with your work with Metanoia Centers that you work with a lot of people in central Illinois in general. What is the problem like there, and how do you think it compares to a place like the Chicago area?
Well, quite naturally, because as Jeff has said, we have a high concentration of homes within Chicago area, and it was one of the areas that were targeted for predatory lending very heavily. But, of course, we do have a large number of foreclosures that are happening all over the state of Illinois. Just in central Illinois, from Danville to Peoria, I probably get a list from the lender servicer I work with, about 75 homeowners on a monthly basis who are either in foreclosure or facing foreclosure.
When I see a number like a 33% increase from in the foreclosure rate from 2011 to 2012, does that tell me that the foreclosures are still there's still a lot moving through the system in Illinois? Are we at the beginning or at the end of this or in the middle?
I think that number could be a bit deceptive in the sense that a lot of the increase in the foreclosure activity we were seeing and we saw in 2012 was really tied to, in part at least, to procedural issues that are related to the way foreclosures are processed in Illinois, and also related to a lot of the controversy, a lot of investigations surrounding, servicer behavior and how servicers handled the foreclosure process. Those two things coming together really caused a pause in the foreclosure process, and then once the foreclosures started up again after those issues were resolved, places like Illinois that are judicial foreclosure states had a backlog essentially because foreclosures just take a little longer to process, and they have to go through the courts, and there's a limited capacity at the court level to process foreclosure cases.
So how old are a lot of these cases that are coming through the courts right now?
I mean, it varies. I mean, you see, you know, data out there that, the foreclosure process in Illinois takes, you know, 600, 700 days. You know, so I think, you know, you saw servicers not filing foreclosure cases or delaying filing foreclosure cases. So it could be that, some foreclosures are years old.
Well, I'm wondering, because Reverend Barnes, I think I first met you in 2007, 2008, when I was doing a story on home foreclosures. I believe the recession had not been started, or at least had not been officially identified at that time, but the foreclosure rate and the bursting of the housing bubble was certainly clear at that time. Is this a long time to have this sort of problem happening, to have it go on for 5 or 6 years?
Well, it's asinine that it has been going on for such a long time. Early on, as board chairperson of National People's Action, we started talking to legislators and the regulators back in 2005 and 2006 when we first started discovering that people were losing their home to predatory lending. Everybody turned a blind ear to us and just did not listen to us. And so the loan pool, the loan pool has been tainted for quite some time. I think we're not even halfway through this subprime debacle. We've got a long ways to go, and right now we've had about 6 million people lose their homes, and we're looking at probably 12 million by the end of 2012 are predicted to have lost their homes or will be losing their homes.
Jeff, does that sound about right to you?
I mean, definitely there have been a lot of folks who've lost their homes. I agree that, you know, in terms of the cycle that we're in related to foreclosures, we're you know, and how that affects the housing market, we've got a long way to go before we emerge kind of on the other end. You know, and I think that that path, that trajectory is different in different types of communities. You know, in Chicago, and I'm sure in downstate areas, you have these neighborhoods where there were high concentrations of subprime lending activity. You saw high concentrations of foreclosure activity, and that foreclosure activity has been persistent and going on for many, many years. And the impacts of those foreclosures, you know, are going to linger for a longer time in those neighborhoods. So I think looking at places like that compared to, you know, parts of suburban, you know, the Chicago region or other parts of downstate, that recovery is going to have a different, is going to look different and have a different path.
Why is Illinois' rate so high compared to, I guess, compared to 45 other states in the union?
Again, I think it's really related to, in part at least, to the judicial process. You know, in Illinois and other places like New York and Florida that also have seen increases in foreclosure activity recently and have, you know, longer foreclosure timeline, those are all judicial states. And that judicial process was, you know, was adopted essentially to give homeowners more opportunity to save their home by putting the foreclosure through the legal system. In states that don't use a judicial foreclosure process, the foreclosure process is very quick. In, you know, say 10 years ago, in a time where, you know, things were more normal, that made a lot of sense as a way to help homeowners stay in their homes. The challenge now is you do have this big backlog. You do have a lot more foreclosure activity, and what the result is sort of this long foreclosure timeline and sort of a kind of a messed up process.
So with states that don't have the judicial process, the foreclosures go through more quickly. Might they have still as many foreclosures if you look over the entire, you know, the entire period of the bursting of the housing bubble and the recession?
Sure. I mean, if you look at places like Nevada, you know, some of the other states that Georgia that have had high levels of foreclosure activity, they have had higher levels of foreclosure activity. What you're seeing is that those foreclosures are, in some cases, moving through the system more rapidly, and you're starting to see, you know, the market rebound a bit more in those areas. And that's sort of the distinction. You know, I mean, if you're looking at helping homeowners, a judicial process is definitely better than a non-judicial process. If your focus is on the housing market and how the housing market, you know, recovers from this process, a non-judicial process is more kind of beneficial to a quicker recovery of the market, which is why in some cases banks prefer the non-judicial process, because they get control of the property faster, they can resell it faster. And in judicial states, there's just more of a lag there. So it really, you know, it's sort of each process benefits, you know, some aspect of the housing market in a different way.
Reverend Barnes, is as far as having a judicial system in Illinois, do you see that as being better overall for the homeowner?
I think the judicial process is quite necessary in holding the lender's feet to the fire in terms of making sure that they're able to exhaust every possible means of relief in order to maintain the homeowners in their home. We don't want foreclosures. We want people to stay in their homes. That's going to keep our community stabilized. But as Jeff is saying, the process can be long, and that's not to the detriment of the homeowner. It's good, especially if the financial institution is pursuing various avenues of relief for the homeowner. So that's good, and some are doing that.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about home foreclosures in Illinois with the Reverend Eugene Barnes of the Metanoia Centers in Champaign. Reverend Barnes is also chairman of the board for National People's Action, of which the Metanoia Centers is a member. And Jeff Smith is here with us with the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. Join us on the air. Call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And you can go to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Just go at Focus580. Talking about the judicial part of Illinois' system, and I was just hoping to get your comments on some rules that were announced last month by the Illinois Supreme Court. And according to the Chicago Tribune, they will require lenders to prove to judges that they have exhausted all efforts to help a borrower before seeking a foreclosure judgment against the homeowner. And I was just wondering to hear from both of you, Jeff, if you have any comment on this. Is this a real problem, and is this a real solution?
I think, you know, this is obviously a response to criticisms that lenders are not exhausting all options to keep homeowners in the home, and not really. There's this homeowner, the HAMP program, essentially. It was designed by the federal government to give lenders, you know, incentives, so to speak, to do loan modification and to keep borrowers in their homes. And the criticism of lenders is that, and of the program, is that it hasn't been effective because lenders aren't really implementing it as much as they should in all the circumstances where there are, you know, available loan modifications. So this sounds like it's really intended to hold lenders more accountable to that. It will, you know, obviously make probably extend the foreclosure process in certain circumstances, but if the outcome is that it helps homeowners stay in their homes, I think it's a good outcome.
Reverend Barnes, and this, as you were talking to me a little bit before we went on air, this sounds like a state response to a national situation and maybe a rule or system that is set to a certain extent by the federal government when it comes to foreclosures.
The failure with HAMP was that it was voluntary on the part of the financial institutions in terms of what they should be doing. It was good business in order to keep people in the home, but still it was voluntary. The greatest problem that I see in terms of holding the banks accountable has been the failure of the feds to upgrade the Community Reinvestment Act. That was a great tool in 1977 when it was implemented to end redlining and to bring the banks into compliance in terms of making good loans to good people. The combination of the judicial process being employed right now and strengthening the Community Reinvestment Act is going to help homeowners stay in their home.
So there is some ground being laid for an improved situation?
Yes. A couple years ago, National People's Action, and Jeff, I believe that you were intricately involved in this in terms of getting the Federal Reserve to come out and come to 10 different cities across the United States just to listen to the ideas that we have in terms of upgrading the Community Reinvestment Act. And so we're waiting to hear how that's going to go along, but that has been a very good tool in holding the banks accountable.
Well, Jeff, I was wondering, maybe just a little history for the last few years. How did we get to this point? We know, you know, there was a housing bubble. We know it burst. I know there were federal efforts to make home ownership possible for more people. How did we get from there to the present day situation?
I mean, really, it all boils down to lack of regulation in the mortgage market. As the Reverend mentioned, you know, the Community Reinvestment Act was designed to provide incentives and oversight of bank activity in low and moderate income neighborhoods. Unfortunately, what happened in the early part of the 2000s was a lot of non-bank lenders started to increasingly make loans that were risky and predatory, and those loans were concentrated in, at least initially concentrated in lower-income African-American communities. But over time, a lot of the features of those products started to permeate the rest of the mortgage market, and so you started to see products that had no down payment required, interest-only loans, different types of adjustable rate products started to become very common in all parts of the mortgage market. And when the housing market collapsed, when price increases became unsustainable, you saw that people were accessing credit to refinance their property in order to keep the mortgage affordable, had no more access to credit, and you saw foreclosures started to uptick. It started in a lot of those neighborhoods where subprime lending was concentrated, but the mortgage bubble, affected the economy. It affected and then started to affect other parts of the housing market. The non kind of in the Chicago area, for example, the suburbs started to also experience increases in foreclosure activity, and so it became not just an issue that was concentrated in these lower income African American Latino neighborhoods, but it affected the entire market.
And I'm sorry, Reverend Barnes, it looked like you were about to say something.
The greater portion of the subprime loans that defaulted were made outside of CRE regulations.
CRE?
CRA, Community Reinvestment Act.
So made outside of that act.
Were made outside of that act, and those were the loans that started to default. And, of course, as mentioned, banking deregulations, the rating companies' failure to properly test the loans that went into the loan pool. The investors were making a lot of money. Nobody wanted to say anything. Deregulation that had been going on such a long time, and it exacerbated itself, and then we have this domino effect. And the mortgage-backed securities, which were the underlying foundation of our economic system with the housing industry, once that collapsed, then we have this problem right now.
Well, I wanted to make a note if you're saying that a lot of these problems happened outside of the Community Reinvestment Act, because I've certainly heard criticism along the lines of, well, it was the federal government's efforts to make home ownership more affordable that went too far, that led to this housing bubble that was destined to burst and lead to these foreclosures.
And that has come from the financial industry, but the statistics and the Federal Reserve has debunked that. It has been demythologized to the point that we recognize right now statistically the loans that did default were made outside the Community Reinvestment Act.
Where are things now? I mean, when you're seeing foreclosures now, in the system, are those from mortgages that were set up when the housing bubble was still a bubble, or are these practices still going on today?
Well, I don't think that the practices are happening today in the great numbers that it used to happen. I wouldn't say that it's not going on, but it's not going on the way that it used to, because now we don't have the subprime market no more. We don't have these exotic loans, these hybrid loans. Then that has eradicated most of the problem. But right now, we're still seeing loans that came around 2005, 2006, and 2007. And then there's a new face of foreclosure. Because the economy has tanked, homeowners are losing their jobs. They don't have enough income, and so now they're losing their home. They were never victims of subprime lending. They were never victims of predatory lending. These are just good people who have lost their income and who can't afford their homes anymore.
Then simply the recession has pushed them into a place where they can no longer afford their mortgages.
Exactly.
Jeff, I wanted to see with you if things look the same way from where you stand at DePaul.
Yeah, I mean, I think, that I agree with the Reverend Barnes's statements that, that's exactly how the crisis evolved. And, what we're seeing in Chicago, at least, is you're still seeing increases in foreclosure activity. And some of the areas that were initially hardest hit by foreclosures, you don't necessarily see increases in foreclosure activity because there's just no more loans in some of these areas left to foreclose on, or there are a declining number of loans left to foreclose on because there have not been a lot of new mortgage originations in those areas. But it is, you know, that's part of the concern is that those markets are, the concern there is what's next? You know, what is going to happen to help those markets rebound? How do you rebuild, you know, those communities? How do you rebuild demand in those areas? And that's sort of one of the major issues that we've been tracking here is sort of, you know, kind of trying to look at what's going on in areas like that and you know, what are some different types of housing market activities and what do they mean for the recovery of these neighborhoods?
Well, that raises a question with me is all of these foreclosed homes which the owners have lost, which have been reclaimed by the banks, have they been reabsorbed by the market? What's happened to all these properties?
You know, it really varies by community. You know, what you see is that they are being absorbed in some cases, but who is buying them is the most interesting thing. And you're seeing a lot of investor activity. You know, and I'm just going to use Chicago as an example, but I'm sure this happens in communities all across the state. You know, you see property values decline to a point where these properties are selling for, say, $20,000, $30,000, which is a very low cost. So investors, you know, and these investors range from small mom-and-pop operations to large national corporations, come in and purchase these properties with cash and as an investment opportunity. In some cases, those properties are absorbed and they're, you know, out of the distressed stock, so to speak, and they're put back online. In some cases, they're used as rental properties. In other cases, they're fixed up and resold as, you know, owner-occupied units. And in still other cases, they're just kind of left to sit and the owner does nothing. And they're kind of hoping for a rebound in the market so they can resell it at some point in the future without having to invest a lot of extra money in that property. So to me, that's one of the most interesting and most important things to track going forward is as you see an increased level of investor activity, you know, what are those investors' business models and how do those business models affect a neighborhood?
So you see different things in different neighborhoods, but it sounds like there's a lot of empty housing stock there. Either it's in some sort of foreclosure foreclosure limbo, or there's also some properties which have been purchased but no one's living in them at this time.
In some areas, in areas that have very weak markets, that is the case. I mean, you see properties stuck in the foreclosure process because it does take a long time. The folks who lived in that home maybe moved because they didn't see any hope that their loan would be modified, and they have other opportunities in other places, so they had to move, and now that property sits vacant. In weaker markets, in areas where there is a lot of vacancy, those types of properties run a risk of deteriorating and becoming blight. And the longer they sit empty, the greater that risk is. So, that is one of the concerns of some of the weaker markets.
Well, Reverend Barnes, I was wondering if you could describe the picture for Central Illinois. We're here right now in Urbana, in Champaign County, big university, big hospitals, a relative amount of economic stability, but still there have been home foreclosures. What's the situation, say, right here in this county?
Well, I don't think it's too much different than what Jeff has already explained. We don't have the concentration that we do in the larger cities, and in terms of a weaker market, we don't necessarily have a weaker market. We have less foreclosures that's happening right now. The great danger in terms of the speculator, the investors, the problem that we saw earlier on was that they were purchasing these properties and they weren't able to maintain the property, and they became what we call phantom properties, and now they're emerging as foreclosed homes. So that wasn't a good solution. What we would like to see the financial institutions do is for foreclosed homes that are sitting, invest in the community. Start investing money back into the community in terms of working with nonprofits to be able to purchase these homes, to be able to rehabilitate them and sell them on the open market and put people in them, even if it's on a rental basis. We have to become more creative in terms of addressing the problem as opposed to waiting for the financial industry to make something happen.
So what you're asking for is that the lenders who now have possession of foreclosed properties to actually be proactive instead of waiting for a buyer to come along to buy the property as is, but to actually take steps or work with other agencies that would take steps. But certainly it sounds like putting up putting up some investment up front on the part of those lenders to do something with the properties.
The banks crashed the economy. They should fix it.
Jeff, is anybody doing that?
Well, I think that, you know, the challenge is our resources, obviously. You know, in Cook County, you know, you do have certain institutions, certain you know, community development focused developers who are acquiring homes and rehabbing them and trying to put them back online. There are federal programs, neighborhood stabilization program, for example, that made funding available to local government to acquire vacant properties and fix them up and put them back on the market. The challenge that a lot of folks are seeing, though, is that in some areas there is limited demand for owner occupancy. There's limited access to credit, so even if households wanted to buy a home to live in it, they have a hard time getting a mortgage. So that's been a challenge to the, you know, evolution of some of these programs. And there's been a shift in some cases to looking at the rental market, and embracing the fact that really, you know, a lot of households are going to be renting for the foreseeable future, and trying to rebuild the supply of rental housing. And the challenge in that segment is, you know, making sure that the rental housing is affordable to folks who are you know, kind of low and moderate income.
The whole subject of owning versus renting is something I want to get into in a little bit. Right now we have a caller, and I want to say good morning to Daryl in Bloomington. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hello. Say you have a house with a $100,000 mortgage, and the owner can't make the payments, and it's worth $50,000. If the owner could make payments based on a $50,000 value, what incentive would the bank have to foreclose on that owner and put it on the market when he's only going to get $50,000 for it anyway? It seems to me like you don't even need a government program to get a lender to do that, because wouldn't he have an incentive anyway to keep that owner in it and refinance it with him? I don't understand why the banks don't do that.
Well, what we would like to see is principal reduction, and one of the reasons right now we have a national campaign to oust Ed DeMarco of the housing.
That's Ed DeMarco, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
And if you had principal reduction, you got a house that's $100,000 but it's only worth $50,000, then principal reduction would come in, and then the bank would make you a new loan, modify that loan to the $50,000, and keeping you in the home. It's to the interest of the servicer or the lender in respect to the investor to keep you in the home.
But it sounds like, as Daryl was saying, well, maybe it would just be common sense on the lender's part to do this. Reverend Barnes or Jeff, are lenders doing this? Do they think it's common sense?
I mean, I haven't seen any data recently on this, but I mean, I know that, yeah, it seems like it's being discussed as a realistic option more. I mean, it's always been on the table, but as the Reverend mentioned, it's not been an option that a lot of lenders have elected to do. And I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons, a lot of complicated reasons why that is. You know, one, I think, you know, is what, you know, if you've got a neighbor, you see two people are next door to each other, one is underwater, they're both underwater, one is delinquent on their mortgage payment, one can make the payments, the principal is reduced on one side. The concern that a bank might have is that that will incent the on-time payer to also default on their mortgage. I don't know if that's a good reason or not, but I've heard that is, you know, is one, you know, kind of one justification for not using principal reduction on a more widespread basis.
And have you heard that yourself, Reverend Barnes, in the cases that you deal with?
I work with Ocwen Financial Services, and Ocwen Financial Services do offer principal reduction. They've purchased Litton Loan, and that's one of the companies that is premier out here right now in terms of setting the stage for other financial institutions to be able to offer principal reduction. And they're doing very good. The investors are happy in terms of the work that they're doing concerning foreclosure with principal reductions.
Well, I want to thank Daryl for calling in with that question. Right now it's time for a short break, and we'll be back with more about home foreclosures in Illinois with Jeff Smith and the Reverend Eugene Barnes. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, back on Focus. We're talking today about home foreclosures, which were up in Illinois last year. We're looking at the problem and possible solutions with Jeff Smith, executive director of DePaul's University Institute for Housing Studies, also U of I alumnus, and the Reverend Eugene Barnes, executive director of the Metanoia Centers in Champaign. He's also chairman of the board of National People's Action. We welcome you to the conversation this morning with your questions. Call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus 580. And for both of you, I was wondering, maybe starting with you, Reverend Barnes, Metanoia Centers, you weren't set up to address the foreclosure problems. You were looking at housing issues many years before this problem came about. What was your initial interest? What was your and goals in working on housing issues?
We saw, again, the Community Reinvestment Act as a good tool to engage the financial industry in terms of working in the disinvested communities. And as we were building houses here in Champaign and in Peoria and considering building homes in St. Louis, we started getting reports on a national basis that people were losing their homes. And I had one particular case from Bloomington where a homeowner called me, and we discovered that she had lost her home to an unscrupulous broker. It took us over a year through the network to be able to resolve this matter, and then we started looking at the great numbers of people that were losing their homes, and we did some investigative work, and we discovered that the problem was not only real, but it was being exacerbated because no one was acknowledging it. For years, for 40 years, National People's Action has been the canary in the coal mine, telling the industry that there's a problem, and nobody really wanted to hear it.
Jeff, I wanted to ask about your organization as well, the Institute for Housing Studies. How long have they been looking at housing?
Well, we've been around since 2007. You know, what we do at IHS is we collect a lot of different types of data on the housing market, primarily in Cook County and in the Chicago region. But we use that data to analyze, you know, what's going on in neighborhoods. We try to mine that data to understand, you know, trends in foreclosure activity and mortgage lending activity in property sales, so that people who are doing work in housing policy and developing housing programs have information about, you know, what's happening in the neighborhoods. And our focus really is, you know, looking at issues like affordable rental housing and how that dynamic is changing in Cook County, looking at, you know, the dynamics of neighborhood market, you know, conditions and like looking at investor buyers, for example, and what implication investor buyers you know, have for the future of neighborhoods. So we, you know, that's sort of what we do. We collect a lot of data, do research with that data, and try to connect it to practitioners.
You mentioning investor buyers maybe chimes in with this comment that we had emailed to us from Deborah. She writes, I have two children trying to buy homes in very competitive markets, Chicago and Los Angeles. Institutional investors who come in with cash are making it very difficult for young adults with low to moderate income to buy their first homes. Does that ring true to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the challenges you're seeing in many markets is, first of all, you have limited access to credit, especially for folks who have low and moderate incomes. Recently, one of the effects of the foreclosure crisis is that banks really tightened their underwriting criteria. So credit scores are higher now for mortgages. Down payments are higher. So if you don't have a down payment, if you don't have a strong credit score, you're going to have a hard time getting a loan. Additionally, appraisals are difficult sometimes to complete because of a lack of comparable sales. So all these factors make it more difficult to get a mortgage and even if you find a property that you like, you think you can qualify for a mortgage, there is a timeline that you have to go through to get a mortgage, and oftentimes those mortgages fail. If a lender is trying to sell a property and they have a person on one hand who's trying to get a mortgage to buy that property, and they have on the other hand a person who comes with cash, they will probably in almost all circumstances, unless they have, they're very mission-driven or mission-focused, will choose the cash buyer, even if the cash buyer is paying slightly less, because what a bank is trying to do, especially in a distressed sale situation, is just get that property off their books. They are just trying to move that property, and they'll take cash for less just for the certainty of that transaction.
You know, on the other hand, if you're renting, what are the options? And you said you were looking at the Chicago area specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Are rental properties as affordable, are more affordable than buying at this point?
Well, I mean, it's a weird thing in the sense that in some, you know, metrics you look at, that you look at, it would seem to show that it's cheaper to buy than to rent in Chicago right now. But that, you know, assumes a number of things. It assumes that you can get a mortgage. It assumes that, you know, you want to own. And I think a lot of people are making the decision to rent because they're not confident in the future of the economy. They're not confident in the housing market. They like the flexibility of renting as opposed to owning. So even if they, you know, could afford to buy, they're choosing to rent. And I think that, but, you know, so I think that's what's driving up rental demand and driving up rents in some cases. And people are willing to pay that. I mean, you know, if they, and other people who don't have the option of buying are kind of being stuck with having to pay a higher rent because they just can't afford to buy. But I mean, from a affordability perspective, I think if you can qualify for a mortgage and you find a house that you like, you know, you probably, you know, dollar for dollar basis, it's cheaper to own, but it's also difficult to sell. So if you are looking to live at a place for 3 to 5 years, it may not make sense to buy, because when you sell it at the end, you may have a hard time doing it. If you're going to be there for 10 years, then, you know, I think then you can afford to buy and you can get a mortgage, then that might be a better option.
Reverend Barnes, what do you think is the best deal for the people you work with, you know, all things considered, if they can get the finances together?
We would like to see people stay in their homes, and that is our main goal in terms of working with the financial industry, to keep people in their home because it's good for the economy. But home ownership is not for everybody. We understand that. And some of the people who are in foreclosure should have never gotten a loan. Most of them were hoodwinked. But getting back, Jeff had mentioned just a credit score and the impossibility that is persistent right now, and just in terms of getting a loan right now. Unless you have a credit score somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 to 800, you can just about forget about it. The other problem that we've looked at is Fair Isaac, which is, you know, the company that gives the credit score. We've been trying to look into just how did they come up with the credit score. And that's more secretive than Bush's baked bean or Colonel Sanders' recipe for fried chicken. We can't get a hold on that. And so many of everybody really uses the credit score in terms of determining whether or not you're going to get credit. We like to be able to look behind the curtain and just see what's involved in that so that they can be a little bit more accountable to the American people in terms of this credit rating.
We've been talking along the while about houses in foreclosure, and whether they just sit there empty with the lender or become phantom properties that are owned by some investor who can't find a buyer or a renter for them. What does this mean for the economy in general in a metro area or a neighborhood? What sort of impact do these properties have?
Well, I think they have a big impact on the overall housing market, or they can at least, because this is, you know, what you call the supply of housing, of available housing for sale, assuming that those properties are for sale. That adds to the supply, which, you know, causes a reduction in price because you've got people. It's a buyer's market or seller's market, and I'm sorry, you know, it increases the supply essentially, which reduces prices, I think, you know, is not necessarily a good thing for the market. In some neighborhoods, in particular, I think you see this impact even felt more significantly in certain communities that have high levels of long-term vacancy. And in those areas, you know, there are a lot of negative impacts that come from long-term vacancy related to increased crime, related to increased blight, related to declining property values for folks who live on the block in occupied properties but are surrounded by vacant properties.
Reverend Barnes, are there any areas in central Illinois which are hit that way, which have sufficiently high numbers of foreclosed homes that neighborhoods are affected?
Well, you could take Decatur, some places in Peoria. You can look at Danville. But the present state of the housing stock within this area, some is just so old that there's not much that you can do with it. But in terms of the foreclosed property, we need to start looking at corrective measures from the municipalities in terms of how they're going to address that vacant property, especially if that property is just sitting and the bank is not taking care of, the servicer isn't taking care of that property. Banks need to have a conversation with the municipalities in terms of what are they going to do in terms of bringing reinvestment in the disinvested areas that they've been the ones who have caused the problem.
While you make that comment, I was thinking of what we were discussing earlier. The Metanoia Center's own offices are in a part of the Bristol Park neighborhood in Champaign, and that part of the neighborhood is identified by the city for urban renewal, which will involve essentially tearing down the current houses, moving folks out, tearing down the current houses, which you tell me the housing stock's in rather poor condition there, and finding a way to work with a developer to start anew. Who owns the property out there? Is that owner-occupied housing in Bristol Park? Are there foreclosed homes there?
There is both owner-occupied and a lot of rental. It's a lot of rental. One of the things that we've seen in urban planning is that in terms of the projects back years ago, it was a very bad idea to concentrate poverty in one area. And so when you look at the Bristol Place community, it has a concentration of poverty, low income, very old housing stock. There's no appreciable value. And I think the oldest home in there is $100,000 in home, which we built. But that doesn't raise the property level. And so we're come to a point right now in terms of what do we do right now in terms of improving the quality of life for the people who do live there. And so City Council has made a wise decision in terms of relocating the individuals, both the few homeowners and the renters, and then do a redevelopment.
This is not a neighborhood that was particularly hit by bad mortgages and home foreclosures, I take it.
No.
Okay. We were talking about concentrations of poverty like that. Jeff, I was wondering, Chicago is an area which is where public housing has gone through dramatic changes with some of the old high rise Cabrini Green Robert Taylor home style buildings actually being torn down and the residents dispersed to other places. What has that meant for housing in general in the Chicago area?
Well, I mean, in Chicago, Chicago and Cook County are among the most segregated places in the country. So when you look at a lot of these phenomenon in the housing market, you look at concentrated subprime lending, you look at foreclosure activity, you look at vacancy, you see that a lot of that plays out along, racial lines in the sense that African-American communities, in some cases Latino communities, are really those that are the hardest hit by a lot of these, a lot of this stuff. So I think that is, a big concern in terms of talking about concentration of these issues and essentially the concentration of the effect of a lot of these, negative things like foreclosure. These neighborhoods bear the brunt of a lot of that.
We're talking about home foreclosures in Illinois with Jeff Smith of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University, and the Reverend Eugene Barnes with the Metanoia Centers in Champaign here on Focus. Let's go back to the phones. Good morning to Lawrence and Savoy. You're on the air on Focus.
Well, thank you. You've partially answered the question just now. But anyway, I would like each of the guests to state where their money comes from to do the things that they are doing.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lawrence. And I'm just wondering, maybe you can just talk about funding, maybe starting with the Metanoia Centers. How do you get your work done?
That's a very good question. In 2005 and 2006, probably 80% of our monies was coming from banks. And we decided that we wouldn't take any more monies from the banks because we discovered that it would have been a conflict of interest on their part. And so right now, mostly I write grants, and that's how I survive.
What type of grants? Who's giving out grants for your sort of work?
I write grants to organizations, Catholic Campaign for Human Development, local grants with the cities. I get grants from Illinois People's Action, which are re-grants, pass-through grants.
Okay. And Jeff, if you could talk about the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul. Do you use any funding outside of just funding from the university itself?
Yeah, most of our funding comes from outside the university. Primarily, it's foundation-related. Foundations will fund us to do different types of research or data collection. But primarily, the funding is to connect that information, the research and the data to different types of housing practitioners from community-based organizations or municipal governments or financial institutions or advocacy groups, connecting the data and the information to their work so they can do it better. And we have small, you know, we sometimes will do contract work for more advanced types of analysis or technical assistance for those groups as well. So that's where the bulk of our money comes from.
Let me go back to the phones, and we have Paul on the line now. Good morning, Paul. You're on Focus.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to ask more about Bristol Place because, you know, it needs to be redeveloped. But I think I don't know if the Reverend is down with everything that they're doing with the sequestering of the Section 8. Champaign doesn't even have an ordinance that requires landlords to take Section 8. So it sort of looks to a lot of people like they're inviting people out of the area. And so I don't know how clear that is, but the whole imbroglio, I don't know, it looks to me like they just want a nicer looking access to the sprawl north of the interstate and developing that, and as opposed to actually being concerned about real housing for these people that live there. And I'd love to be disabused of the notion, but I just think that the people on the lower ends of it are really getting buffeted around. We can talk about hardships in the people who are underwater, but people are out of housing. And, well, thank you. I'm sorry I haven't tuned in from the beginning, so maybe some of this was already treated. But.
Well, we can talk a little bit about that. Thank you for calling, Paul. Reverend Barnes, what's happening to the folks who are being moved out of Bristol Place?
And I hear the concern in your voice for the people. I've been in this community in Bristol Place for the past 12 years trying to work with the city and the housing authority to address this problem. One, we're concerned with the quality of life. Two, the property values are so low in the community that we have been unable to get investors who are willing to invest in rehab. And after a while, the house is too old and the amount of money that you have to put into it just makes it untenable for a financial institution to invest in it. The quality of life concerns what can we do to make life better for the people who are there. It is a high crime-ridden area. The shootings and robberies that happen there, I've got bullet holes in my windows. It's a very unsafe neighborhood. We can leave it as it is and continue to allow the situation to exacerbate itself to a point where we really have nothing to work with. Some of the homes in there are still good homes. There's a few homes in there, and I believe that the city might consider just moving those homes out of there. But there has not been a hard and fast move just to throw and kick the people out of the neighborhood. That has not been the case. I've been marking time over there for quite some time, and I think we're just hard-pressed in terms of what we're going to do. And I think right now the decision has been made. It's going to be the best both for that neighborhood and this community at large.
Jeff Smith, I want to go back to you in the last couple of minutes of the program, returning to the subject of foreclosures. Looking ahead, do you see any light at the end of the tunnel, and do you see anything that qualifies as really as a more permanent solution to keep the sort of thing that we saw with all these foreclosures of the last few years from happening again?
Sure. I mean, in terms of light at the end of the tunnel, you know, looking at Chicago, you know, again, what we're seeing is a divergence of markets. So you've got strong neighborhoods, strong submarkets that are emerging from the housing and foreclosure crisis in fairly good shape. They've seen long-term property appreciation, and they're starting to see short-term property appreciation as well on a year-over-year basis. What you're also seeing in terms of some of the hardest-hit neighborhoods is that some of those areas are finally hitting what appears to be a bottom. I mean, property values are starting to rebound again. Now, those property values are at levels well below what they were in 2000. So there, you know, so there is no long-term price appreciation in those areas, which is bad news for the people who live there. But what you're seeing, the positive activity you're seeing in some of these areas is that people, investors by and large, are coming in, purchasing properties, you know, for a very low value and reselling them or flipping them for a slightly higher value. Now, you know, again, that's purely from a data perspective. That seems to show positive indicators in terms of price. What you don't know so much is, you know, are those good transactions? Are those fraud? Are those people? I mean, if you're talking about selling those properties to owner-occupants, that's a positive. If you're talking about just reselling them among investors, then, you know, that could be, you know, a negative potentially. So I think, again, looking forward, that's the issue I think that's going to be really important to keep tracking is who's buying these properties and what does that mean for neighborhoods.
Well, we're going to have to end it there simply because we're out of time, not out of questions about this issue. But we've been talking about home foreclosures in Illinois with Jeff Smith of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University and the Reverend Eugene Barnes with the Metanoia Centers in Champaign. Thank you both for being with us on Focus today. And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. We are likely the first result on your search engine if you type in WILL Focus. Tomorrow on Focus, fracking could be coming to Illinois soon. A bill in Springfield to regulate the practice has input from both the energy companies and the environmental groups, and we will be talking about that tomorrow on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Thank you for being with us.